Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth since, 2006, I guess it is. It's been an interesting decade, and I've met a lot of interesting folks along the way, people with a lot to contribute to understanding what's really happening in the world. And my guest tonight, Paul Levy, is at the very top tier of people with uncommon insights into not just sort of the obvious things that they're not telling us, the obvious lies at the surface, but the deeper structures that are producing those lies. His books, The Madness of George W. Bush, A Reflection of Our Collective Psychosis, and Wetiko, The Greatest Epidemic Sickness Known to Humanity, are two invaluable resources in understanding not just politics, but what lies deep down beneath the surface politics. And that's a good way to get really situated and oriented on election night. So, hey, Paul, it's been a few years. How have you been, and how's the world been?
I've been good. Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, it's good to be here, and particularly on election night. It just feels so intense just in the air, just the madness, really.
You described it so beautifully in both of your books, which really are kind of an unbroken development of your thought. In the Bush book, you argued that, Bush and the terrorists kind of like with a schizoid sort of set of projections of each other's dark side, that there's a splitting going on that leads to this extreme tension, and this is a kind of madness. It happens within a person. It happens within Bush as he cuts himself off from this dark side, and then it happens on the grand scale with his war on the evil terrorists. Do we see something going on like this in this election, with a kind of a split in America's deep collective unconscious between, the people who absolutely hate Trump and the people who absolutely hate Hillary?
Yeah, no, that's totally true. And, the whole fundamental core of my work is that what's playing out in the outer world is a function of actually a deeper process that's happening in the human psyche, in the collective unconscious itself. And in the human psyche, there is an incredible split. There's this disassociation between the opposites, really. And that takes all sorts of forms, how it plays out in the world theater. So yeah, to answer your question, it's like it's the current day iteration of that same disassociation that we saw back when Bush was president. It's playing out. It's been playing out now in the whole election that we're going through. And, so it's kind of funny for me because people in the mainstream think of my work as really out there and they can't wrap their head around it. And yet it's so obvious what I'm pointing at, that what's actually playing out in our world, the origin of it is the human psyche.
It's not that hard to wrap your head around if you have looked into some of the areas that you've looked into, like Jungian theory and quantum mechanics, which tells us that we're actually sort of creating reality or influencing how it comes out of nowhere, that nothing exists in reality except for these wave functions, just waves, probability or possibility waves, and then actual reality doesn't happen until somebody looks at it, or, maybe a whole lot of somebody's look at it, and then it collapses into, the particles that make up our world. Once you've got that, and then you look into the psi issue, this precognition and telepathy and that stuff, which really does exist, you look into these kinds of sources, and what you're saying suddenly makes total sense. I think it's just that people haven't been educated in enough of these cutting-edge fields.
Yeah, and one other way of saying that is that it's as if people are under a spell, and the spell, and the main organ that really is propagating the spell is the mainstream media. And, there are all these other ways of describing it, that people are just asleep to what's actually happening. It's very much like being in a dream at night and not recognizing that you're dreaming and thinking the dream is actually objectively that it's real, separate from your own consciousness. And then you actually react to the dream and become conditioned by its manifestations. But by its manifestations, when in actuality, the dream is just your own energy. And you just haven't recognized that. So it's a similar thing. So if any of us, if we're having this reaction, this visceral reaction to Trump or to Hillary, the point is that, you're looking in a mirror. And etymologically, the word mirror means shadow holder. So you're seeing your own shadow in reflection, and that part of you that has that trigger, that like recoil, that's information about, oh yeah, they're reflecting back some part of yourself that you just can't stand. So it's actually, from the spiritual point of view, it's a real opportunity for people to get in touch with potentially with unconscious parts of themselves that might be emerging, into consciousness.
Wow, well, I knew that this election was actually good for something.
Yeah, really.
Jung said that the sort of shadow side of the male is usually female or feminine, and the shadow side of the female is male or masculine, this animus thing. And maybe that would explain the gender gap to a certain extent, that Trump represents this kind of repressed side of women, this really aggressive kind of boisterous loudmouth male egotistical character that is not what most women kind of act out as their main persona. And likewise, Hillary Clinton has a certain scary kind of image to a lot of men, that there's something about this female seeking her own power and stuff that really scares men.
Yeah, no, and that's true. And I mean, I just have to say, I just, because this is important in our lifetime. I mean, I've never seen an election like this. Where both candidates, I mean, I couldn't in good conscience vote for either one. I mean, and live with myself.
Right on.
And and that's never happened to me before. There's always been one, candidate that I thought, okay, this one, I prefer. This one is better in these ways.
Or at least a lesser evil.
Yeah, but the thing, so what, one of the things that gets my attention is what is up in us that we as a nation of however many 300 plus million people would literally dream up these two candidates that are just horrendous. Like, what is that an expression of that's going on in the collective unconscious? And that, I'm not sure how to answer that, but that, because, it just seems like sometimes it's important to ask the right question, and that certainly seems like one of the right questions.
Absolutely. Well, I tried to put forward some tentative answers in this piece I published yesterday. It's entitled "Hillary versus Donald: Our Archetypal Bad Parents." And my hypothesis, Paul, is that the family structure in Western culture is falling apart as people become more individualistic, egotistical, self-centered, whatever you want to call it. They're living for physical power and pleasure and social status. And it used to be that basically most of life was self-sacrifice. You sacrificed for your community and your family, and you really hardly did anything for yourself. And this was true for women, of course, whose almost their entire lives was giving birth to nursing and raising children, but also for men whose entire lives were drudgery, just really tough, hard dog-eat-dog work in a very, very tough world, so they could support that family. And most of their energy was not supporting themselves, but rather it was, being given to help women and children. And now we're in this world where men's energy is mostly going for their own gratification, and they're not, like, you don't have to get married to have sex anymore. It's why buy a cow if the milk is free? And so, men are in it for themselves, and that's what testosterone and male ego drive people to do, which is why young men are always the problem in every culture. But now we're a culture of not grown up men. And in most cultures, when you have men who are not harnessed into marriage and into sacrificing almost all of everything they do and all their energy for the women and children, those men become rapists and predators. And that's basically what we are. We're just a slightly less obvious grade of rapist and predator as modern men. And women who have always given up themselves for their roles as taking care of little children, they throw their babies in daycare at 6 weeks. They have abortions left and right, and if they have a kid, they throw it in daycare at 6 weeks. They put on shoulder pads and go out to fight in the workforce to get a little more status and money so they can have more, ego gratification as they look in the mirror and stuff. So we've become a nation of very, very selfish people and very, very bad parents. And I think what we're seeing in this election is, the archetypal bad parents. I mean, Hillary, I mean, she's supposedly, she's had about a zillion abortions. She's primarily lesbian. She spent her life covering up Bill's rapes and his pedophilia on Jeffrey Epstein's planes and so on and so forth. And Trump has done the same kind of stuff. I mean, he's a mobster. He was got to start with Cohn in the Meyer Lansky mob, and he's been to those Epstein parties too. He's done all that stuff, and he's all in it for himself, as is obvious if you listen to him for about 10 seconds. You know, he's the kind of father that would be just a nightmare to have a father like that. I mean, you'd hardly ever see him, and if you did, it would be all about him. And he'd probably throw you under the bus if he could, you know, make another buck. So, I mean, these are like the worst possible parents. And in this election, it's the first time we're choosing a national parent rather than necessarily a national father. We've got these two evil parents, the most utterly archetypally evil parents you could ever dream up. And their marriage is breaking up as they go on television in these debates and just cut each other down as evilly as they possibly can. I mean, to me, it's obvious that that's what this is really about.
Yeah, well, what you're saying, I don't disagree with at all. And but I want to add, like in any sort of a dream, you have a dream at night and it's multidimensional, which means there are multiple, you know, these levels of meaning. There's not just, oh, it means this and that's it. So that's one level of meaning. And but I would point out that's only one level of meaning enfolded in multiple levels of meaning. For example, what you were pointing out about, oh, yeah, people are just in it for themselves, or they're, you know, it's like an adolescent culture. Yeah, I would language that by saying, yeah, you know, one of the aspects of this madness that I actually want to get into more is the fact that so many of us in the United States, and not just in this country, but all around the world, have an identification with the separate self, that where we actually think that we're separate from the environment, and we actually think that we're separate from each other. And as long as we identify in that way and hold that viewpoint, then being like a dream, because that's the main thesis of my work. My whole work is based on, oh, this is a collective dream that we're all dreaming up together. As soon as you hold a viewpoint in a dream, the dream being nothing other than a reflection of your perspective, will have no choice but to shapeshift and reflect back to give you all the evidence confirming the seemingly objective truth of the viewpoint that you're holding. So if somebody thinks, oh, I'm separate from you and I'm separate from the universe, well, then they're going to get all the evidence they need that justifies and proves to them that their viewpoint is correct. So it becomes a self-perpetuating feedback loop. And that's it's in the actual essence of that is some sort of self-created hypnotic spell that we're creating on ourselves. And of course, mainstream media is continually fanning the flames of that and cultivating that in so many different ways, whether it's with competition or consumerism or whatever. Yeah, so I don't disagree at all. I just wanted to sort of add some stuff to that.
That's a great point. And it's that kind of disease of ego-driven separation, I think, that's really behind the malignant side of this situation I described, which is also, of course, the theme of your book, Wetiko. And, you know, another side of this election psychologically that kind of, you know, worries me a little bit, because partly because of who I am, I see myself being reflected back at me in a certain way with Trump, in that Trump, in a way, is a kind of a funhouse mirror, you know, monster, scary reflection of the conspiracy theorist. You know, the New York Times called this the conspiracy theorist election, and they put a picture up of Trump, you know, peering through the window blinds, you know, looking like a paranoid conspiracy theorist. And he has raised all of these issues, or not all of them, but a lot of these issues. He said Bush was responsible for 9/11, and the Republicans went bananas. He said Ted Cruz's dad, you know, was there with Lee Harvey Oswald and tied to the JFK assassination, which he was, actually. And he's, you know, talked about globalization, the international banksters, all of these kinds of things, a long list of conspiracy theories. But the way he raises them is this very sort of paranoid, you know, they're out to get me. Or, you know, he's resonating with people who feel helpless and, you know, messed over in today's world and feel sort of egotistically at odds with these big, terrible forces, and then become, you know, kind of paranoid and kind of egocentric. And that's kind of how he comes off. So to me, he's also kind of a weird reflection of the kind of work that I do.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I totally hear that, and it, because one of the things that you're pointing at is that, both Trump and Hillary are fanning the flames of fear, which, I mean, that's an expression of that separate self, because as soon as there's fear, there's other. And the thing in my book, the Watiko book, I talk about that. What Watiko is, it's a Native American term which connotes the spirit of evil, like a cannibalistic spirit. And it basically informs all of the evil that our species is playing out on each other and collectively throughout the greater body politic. And it feeds off of polarization. So if there's fear, it's almost like you could think of it, it's like a bug. It's like the, it actually is a parasite of the mind, so to speak. And its food is fear and separation and polarization. And if you think about like what's happening in the discourse politically these days, it's totally, there's incredible fear that's just being continually cultivated all, just every day.
And what's really strange about this is that it seems that the sort of big mythic fear that Hillary points to is Putin in Russia. And the big mythic fear that Trump points to is ISIS and the radical Muslims. And both of those entities are total non-threats to normal Americans. I mean, Russia has a, it's probably, I think it's just got a smaller GDP than California. It's minute. It's like not a big scary country that's coming to take us over by any means. And these radical Islamic terrorists are, of course, a complete joke. The FBI has to manufacture all the terror plots in the United States, even if you count 9/11, which was a false flag, and a couple of other false flags as well. You're more likely to die from, drowning in your bathtub or be hit by lightning than to get killed in a terror attack. So there's no terror threat to Americans. There's no Russian threat to Americans. And yet, these are kind of the two big mythic, scary issues that the candidates raise.
Yeah, well, no, that's true. And when you look at it from the psychological point of view, there's a dynamic, a psychological dynamic that underlies that process, like everything really we're talking about, and the whole idea of Watiko, same thing. There's the same psychological process, and it has to do with if we're not owning our own darkness, our own evil, then what do? We split off from it, we project out the shadow. And if I can just describe how that works, because it's really, it's one of the ways of articulating this, this Watiko idea, is that, so if you just think about for a moment, if we're in a night dream and if we split off from our own darkness, well, what happens? Because we've split off from our own evil, it's projected out into the dream, and then into the dream will walk somebody who's embodying, who's carrying our projection, and they'll seem really evil. And then, of course, we react to that in whatever way we do, but we're reacting to our own energy. Well, the whole point is that in the waking dream, if we project out, if we're not, if we dissociate and split off from and aren't owning our own darkness, we then project out the evil outside of ourselves. And then, of course, somebody will embody that. Somebody will be carrying our projection. And then we'll see the evil outside of ourselves, in whether it's in ISIS or Putin or whoever it is. And then we have evidence. Oh, now I have proof that the evil is really out there outside of myself. So we become even more entrenched in that viewpoint of that, well, I'm light and there's the dark. And then, of course, what do? We try to destroy the evil that we're seeing out there, because that's a reflection of the initial impulse of trying to get rid of the darkness that originally belonged to us. So, but by trying to destroy the evil out there, we literally become possessed by the very evil we're trying to destroy. And what I just described, that's Watiko in a nutshell from the psychological point of view. And that's a way of describing, of articulating the psychological process that's playing out in the body politic of the world.
And especially the USA, I would argue that, no country may, possibly Israel, actually, which is kind of merged with the U.S. in a certain respect, both, I think, drawing on Old Testament, whether it's, Jewish or Protestant versions of it, to, have this mythos of conquest and so on, and being the God's chosen and all of that. But it seems to me that the U.S. in particular being so powerful, you know, having come to this position by exploiting all of these resources on the North American continent and being able to basically kind of run much of the world from North America without having any formidable enemies. I mean, the last serious enemy the U.S. ever faced was the British in the War of 1812. And since then, there hasn't been a single threat to the United States, except, of course, Civil War in 1860. But so we don't have any real threat that's coming to get us. So instead, we've had to come up with this kind of projection mechanism that you described, in which we imagine that there is some threat coming to get us, and then we pin that imaginary persona, that mask, onto somebody or something. Like, we blow up our own battleship, the USS Maine, in Havana Harbor, and say it was those evil Spaniards that they're coming to get us, and so we have to squash them. And likewise, you know, in the World Wars, likewise with Vietnam, with the Gulf of Tonkin. That's why we have all these false flags, is that they're designed to create this image that there's this evil other who's coming to get us. But because we're so powerful and there's no other that can threaten us, we have to become our own evil other. And we do that very, very well. And I don't think there's any country on earth that does it as intensely and, you know, over the top as we do. Sure, they all use false flags. Putin got into power with a false flag apartment bombing, blamed on the Chechens and so on. But I think that the U.S. and then Israel, if, you know, adjusted for size, Israel per capita population probably does this at least as much as we do. But, you know, because we're the biggest bully on the block, we do it the most and the best. And so I think the United States of America is the world capital of Wetiko. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I would say it's our major export, basically. And that's true. And keep in mind, one of the questions you ask is, you know, who benefits when we have an enemy, whoever the enemy is of the day. And of course, you know, it's the defense contractors, it's the military industrial complex that benefit, because they make billions of dollars in creating weapons to fight this enemy. And you know, and I just want to say one thing about the whole conspiracy theory thing, because I just want people to understand that word was invented by, I think it was the CIA. It was after the Kennedy assassination and after the Warren Commission. They coined that phrase to label and to concretize anybody who didn't subscribe to the collective story that was being, you know, propagated by the mainstream, you know, sort of thinking. They were labeled a conspiracy theory as a way, you know, as a way of invalidating their thinking. And so it's just really interesting where so many people, so many of us who are like actually not being brainwashed by the propaganda of the mainstream media and are following what's actually happening and are pointing at it, then we just get labeled, oh, they're conspiracy theorists, and then our voices marginalized and all that. And that, but I want to point out, that's part of the way Wetiko works, because keep in mind, the thing about Wetiko is that it's an inner disease of the soul, of the psyche. It's it's a actual, you know, it pervades the collective sort of unconscious of our species. And it actually, being an inner disease of the soul, somehow is able to sort of transgress the boundary between inner and outer in such a way that it configures events in the outer world so as to synchronistically reflect and express what's going on inside of the psyche. So that's like this radical thing. There's nothing else like that. So I just want to repeat that. It's an inner disease of the soul, which explicates itself through the medium of the outside world. So what that means is, when you see the correlation between what's actually playing out in the outer world and our inner process of what's going on inside of us, that's when we begin to, where we're onto the footprints of Wetiko. And what I just described, that's exactly what a dream is. A dream, when you're in a dream, the outer dreamscape is actually not separate from the inner psyche of the dreamer. The dreamscape is the actual manifestation of the inner psyche. And when you actually have lucidity in a dream and wake up, you recognize that correlation. That's what I'm pointing at in my work, that's, in a sense, the cure for Wetiko disease.
And that's such an interesting insight to apply that, you know, think about this election, if it's a dream, you know, what's really going on here, you know, and those of us who were terrified of both candidates, who were, you know, horrified and embarrassed by both candidates, what side of ourselves does this represent? You know, because that is the great Jungian insight about dreams is, there's something that bothers you or something that scares you about someone or something in this dream you just had, the question to ask is, what part of yourself is that? It's part of, you know, which part of yourself? And so which part of ourselves is creating this election? Which part of ourselves is creating this endless conflict with the whole world that's turned into this war on terror? Wow.
Yeah, and the thing is, I mean, that was what I was trying to get across in my book about Bush's madness, you know, because I was just saying it over and over again that, you know, we as a collective, we actually dreamed up, at that point it was Bush, to embody our own ignorance, our own madness. But when you see that, and that's to see that, oh, it's like a dream, it's a reflection, then all of a sudden there's no separation. He's not some other out there. He's being a dream character. He's an embodied reflection of a part of us. You see, because the thing about Watiko, like I was saying, it feeds off of separation. It feeds off of, for example, if I think, oh, well, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, if they have Watiko, and if I think they have Watiko and I don't, well, then guess what? By holding that point of view, then I'm as much under the thrall of Watiko as they are. You know, because it feeds off of separation. But if I see, oh, there's evil coming through Donald Trump or evil coming through Hillary Clinton, and that's a reflection of the evil inside of me, then all of a sudden Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, they're not separate from me. And all of a sudden then it becomes a doorway to deepening my understanding of more of the depths, of the darker depths that possibly, you know, are inside of me.
And does that hold for the more benevolent things that we see outside of ourselves, such as, I actually voted in this election. In the primary, I voted for Bernie Sanders, and I just voted for Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka today. When I look at them, they, you know, that looks to me like there's a lot of you know, good stuff, especially Stein and Baraka. But even Bernie Sanders had a certain amount of refreshing approaches to really core problems. So when you see good stuff out there in the world, is what's that message for you?
Oh, yeah, no, totally. It's absolutely, you know, it's all reflection. There's no like, oh, only this is a reflection and that's not. You know, but the thing, I guess for me, one of the interesting points is that, so encoded, hidden within the darkness, hidden within the seeming evil, it has a blessing. It's potentially helping us to wake up to who we are and to the dreamlike nature. Because when I say the dreamlike nature, keep in mind, this is because I just finished a book on quantum physics. It's not published yet. But the major insight of quantum physics is that they've discovered, oh, it makes no sense at all. You can't even talk about there being an objective world outside of the observer, that the observer and the observed, that they actually, you know, you can't, they're not separable. It's one quantum system. It's one quantum process. And so, you know, what that means is that the way we're, as a, for example, if I were a quantum physicist, the way that I'm observing my experiment actually influences the results of the experiment. Well, that's exactly like a dream. If I change my perspective within a dream, the dream has no choice but to spontaneously shapeshift and reflect back my change in my viewpoint, because it is nothing other than my psyche. And so, you see, that's where it gets really interesting and really creative, because, you know, we have this incredible power to influence and to affect reality, but so many of us are just asleep to it. But that power, we're wielding it anyway, but we're wielding it unconsciously in a way that's imprisoning us, that's killing us.
And when we think about the observer that creates the universe, there's a kind of a fuzziness there in terms of, you know, who or what is the observer, or are there observers plural? And I guess I end up sort of trying to imagine a higher observer than just this me that's kind of locked up inside of my skin and looking out from behind my eyeballs. And I have had this experience, of course, as I think everyone probably has in dreams and so on, of, you know, attaining a somewhat call it higher or more comprehensive sort of observational viewpoint. And so let's imagine the highest ultimate viewpoint the ultimate observer with a capital O, call that God if you're from the monotheistic tradition. You know, I have taken actually as my Muslim name Abdul Basir, the servant or slave of the seer. You know, Basir is the seer, and that would be the ultimate observer. That is the most, you know, the source of everything. That is the most comprehensive view that's making everything, you know, come into existence, which is a unified source. And I mean, does your take on things go that far?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because as you were talking, I was thinking, well, you know, but we aren't separate from that. Like that higher observer, yeah, to the extent that we're deluded or we're like wounded and seeing through our unhealed abuse issues and we're seeing through our particular filter, we're seeing in like this limited way. But the idea is that, you know, when you clear off the obscurations, you know, you have clear seeing. And then who is the one who's having that clear seeing? Well, it's the true nature. It's, you know, whatever. It's that higher perspective. And so, yeah, no, it sounds like what you were just saying is very much the same of, you know, my whole point of view. But then what's interesting to me is that our nature, that true nature that we all share, that it's creative, that we are creative beings and we're creating. You know, I'm not like this new agey person who's like, oh, we just create reality, because that, you know, there's like such a this conflation of ego and self in that way. But I'm talking about that moment by moment, we are creating our experience of the universe and we are creating our experience of who we actually experience ourselves to be. And that's a point of power, that when you discover that, then all of a sudden, you know, you're connecting with yourself as an artist, as a creative being. And that's where you're actually accessing your deeper power. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that creativity is a key thing here, that acknowledging our part in creating, you know, should make us value that even more. But in a sense, the highest form of creativity is when the lower level self really kind of gets out of the way.
yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I experienced that when I, you know, because I'm not any, you know, awakened person by any means of the imagination, but I'm a creative writer. And, you know, so it's not just like, oh, it just flows out of me. You know, like sometimes I have to twist myself into a pretzel to, you know, to write, you know, like a sentence or something like that. But the point is that there are times where I'll feel like I'll just get out of my own way. And then I feel almost like I get dictation, like I'm channeling something, like, you know, I'm hearing this inner voice that's telling me what I'm going to write about. It's showing me how I'm going to write about it. And then I'm like at that point, just an employee. And then when I finish writing, I'll read what I wrote and I'll be like, wow, who wrote this? You know, and it's just exactly what you were saying. You just get out of your own way.
Right. And, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, I remember back when I was young and stupid, once I smoked some ganja and wrote all night and thought it was sort of genius level Finnegan's Wake right. stuff.
Totally. Until you read it the next morning.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a kind of getting out of the way that doesn't work as well. Do you think that art in the modern sense is messed up and is infected with Wetiko compared to like sacred art of the past? I actually met this guy in Morocco who carves doors. He carves one door per year. His name is Al-Andalusi. He comes from the family that was driven out of Spain in that big ethnic cleansing. And so anyway, he carves one huge door, just beautiful, amazing, you know, arabesques all over this wooden door. And he does that for a year and sells it. I think he was selling them for like, you know, 15,000 or so. So that's his income, is one door per year. It was about 15,000 in 1999, 2000. Anyway, he goes into a trance and gets the vision that he's going to carve from the prophet Solomon, or so he says. Mm. And he's not signing that door. You know, he's making a living off it, but he's getting zero real ego gratification from it. He's just getting out of himself and letting the vision from the prophet Solomon guide what he carves. And this is how sacred artists have always done it in all cultures. They weren't, you know, most of them weren't running around signing their work or, you know, getting record contracts and boasting and, you know, tweeting and like me kind of stuff. And then, you know, since we've been, you know, in this post-Renaissance kind of modern Western-driven period, art has gotten all mixed in with ego, it seems to me. And so creativity and ego, you know, kind of have this weird relationship with each other where ego gratifications drive a lot of creativity, but I'm not sure that that's to the good.
Yeah. No, well, that's because of the creative process and being an artist in this culture that we live in, being such a materialistic culture, I mean, has been corrupted. And because art is a sacred vocation. And so, you know, I just say, because so many, when people are really suffering, as so many of us are, you know, in this day and age, you know, I mean, think about it. There is a collective psychosis of titanic proportions that pervades, you know, our planet that hardly anybody is even talking about, you know, which itself is an expression of the depth of the insanity. And so when I, you know, because I have a private practice and I work with a lot of people, And so often, if not always, what really is the very key that helps people to be able to connect with themselves and to feel, basically to feel better, is if they're able to connect with their voice and to express themselves creatively. It's almost as if, oh, then they begin to have experience of, oh, this is what I'm here to do. And so I would just say for, you know, to everybody that, you know, we're all here to connect with whoever it is we are. And we're all one of a kind, you know, beings. And to the extent that we're not really, you know, creatively expressing ourselves for whatever reason, whether we heard a story when we were younger that we're not good enough or we're not talented or whatever the narrative is. But if we've bought into that and subscribed to that, you know, then we become sort of this neurotic person who pretty much you can guarantee is going to feel depressed and anxious and not fulfilled in a spiritual way. Because for me, to be a creative artist is a spiritual vocation.
And maybe this is partly what's driving the frustration that we're seeing coming out in this election is, you know, we're going through a transition phase economically. In the past, since industrialization, most people, you know, had to migrate from peasant farms to cities to work in industrial jobs and industrial support jobs. And that was basically what people did, was, you know, mostly manufacture stuff. And a lot of the jobs, most of the jobs were basically unskilled. You know, industrialization de-skilled the labor force. And so we're kind of hitting the tail end of that period now as productivity without unskilled labor input is rising and rising and rising. And it's pretty soon it's going to hit the point where there's going to be zero unskilled labor input. There will be robots that can do everything that an unskilled person can, and most of what skilled people can as well. At least that's what they're telling us over in the AI laboratories, and they sound pretty confident about that. So it seems that the folks who have been able to, you know, get by it's not just people who were doing relatively unskilled jobs, but even a whole lot of other people who are also being displaced are kind of saying, what are we supposed to be doing here? You know, what we thought we were doing that was making a contribution to the world, it's totally replaceable. And, you know, the jobs that are left are few, far between. Benefits are slashed, pay is slashed, material life scale is going down. And this is true for almost every, for 90% of the people at least, the material level of life is going down here in the USA. And the, you know, for 10%, it's going up a little bit. And, you know, the higher you get up the scale, the more it's going up. And so this situation is a kind of a weird, nightmarish situation. And I think especially for the people who are being knocked out of their jobs and their role in life first, which is the kind of the relatively unskilled working class folks who were making a great living when I was born in 1959, and it got better for a few years. We had truck drivers making more money than school teachers when I was a kid, and factory workers in Detroit making more money than either. And that's all gone now, totally gone. And so we have a lot of really angry working class people, and the white ones like Trump, and the non-white ones really hate him. And because what are we supposed to be doing in life? And apparently these robots will be able to do everything except maybe creativity for quite a while. So creativity is kind of the last human thing that humans can do. But seriously, do you think that this is going to be a solution for everybody? I mean, it seems to me that it might get worse before it gets better.
Well, the thing is, I mean, from the dreaming point of view, if you think about it from that point of view, and that's to say, like, what if we interpreted what's happening in our world as if it's a dream? Like, what would that be showing us? Like, if we had a dream just last night that there was this crazy election between Hillary and Trump and blah, 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 how would we interpret that when we woke up? Well, the thing from one thing that jumps out to me is that, sort of the evil and the shadow and the powers of darkness, they're coming out from hiding. They're, for so much of our lives, they were like hiding underground or in the corners, where now they're just out and everybody sees them. But that, from the dreaming point of view, is an expression that light is nearby, because when light floods in to a system, to a universe, what happens? It illumines the dark, and the dark all of a sudden becomes visible. And so what seems to be things are getting worse from the dreaming point of view could potentially, it could mean, oh, wow, no, but actually light is really flooding in and things are potentially, getting better. So I think it's really interesting to hold an expansive viewpoint of how we interpret phenomena, okay? Because if we interpret things in a negative way, in a pessimistic way, for example, if I'm in a dream and hold a pessimistic point of view, well, then, like I was saying before, the dream being nothing other than my own mind is going to reflect back and offer all the evidence that confirms my pessimism. And now I have objective truth of that. So I get more fixated in that point of view in a self-perpetuating, self-created feedback loop. You see, that's the power. We're like these creative, like, geniuses, all of us are. And we've actually forgotten. We have amnesia about our nature. And so what I'm saying is, yeah, fundamentally, that connecting with that creative genius, with our creativity, that really, there's no way around that. That has to be a major part of the solution to the world crises that we face.
And I think the listeners to this show might be especially interested in thinking about how this kind of creativity as a solution to a lot of the sort of psychological difficulties we face interfaces with this process of shining light into the darkness, which is what we're doing here at Truth Jihad Radio. And it can be discouraging sometimes because we see so many ugly things. I mean, if you listen to this radio show, you hear about false flag operations, murderous ones, murdering 3,000 people on 9/11, and on and on and on. These monsters in control assassinating the relatively good leaders, and mind control programs, and pedophilia blackmail operations that apparently have control of both major candidates, and organized crime everywhere, and all of these really horrible things going on, which we specialize on in here at Truth Jihad Radio. Well, what we're really doing is shining light on those things, as you say, and shining light on the darkness and actually bringing light into the system. And the solution to this is going to be using creativity to figure out how to communicate this light, how to keep shining more and more light until we can get enough light to actually improve the situation and to, force some of these really dark things out of the system.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I could just say, because what you're bringing up, like, this huge issue, because, like, for example, the city I'm in, the major, this metaphysical bookstore that I've been teaching at for like 20 something years, they won't even carry my books because,
amazing.
They're so overly identified with the light. And here I'm talking about, the major book is, the subtitle is Breaking the Curse of Evil, Dispelling Watiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil. That's the book that I'm kind of known for. But they won't even like let the book in the store, basically, because it has the word evil in the title, because they're so freaked out by the darkness and identified with the light. Where I'm like, in the book, what I'm talking about is that, wait, well, light make it's no value. Light doesn't mean anything unless it illumines darkness. that's its function, you know? So seeing the darkness is an illumination. And so what I'm talking about, and this isn't just me, people way smarter than me are saying, no, the idea of waking up and becoming enlightened is actually making the darkness conscious, bringing the darkness into the light and adding awareness to it, you know? And so that's, I mean, that's what you're doing and that's what I'm doing and that's what a lot of people are doing. But people who are just like these, this spiritual bookstore, they're just so afraid of darkness. And by being identified with the light, and they're just in avoidance, they're avoiding relationship with whatever the darkness brings up in themselves. And without knowing it, they're unwittingly feeding the darkness by their contraction against it. And, you know, so the other part of that is that, oh, if I or anybody gets too overly fascinated by the darkness, well, then I'm feeding it too. But the point is, what I'm pointing out is, no, we need to see how it operates. How, you know, what the native indigenous people call Watiko or evil or whatever word you use, how it operates. You see how it operates in the outside world with our complicity, unconsciously, and how it operates in our own mind. And when you see it, then you can choose to look to say, okay, now I don't want to like focus on you. Now I want to place my attention on the world I want to create. That's not feeding the evil. That's actually dispelling the darkness. And that's becoming a real agent of light.
And that sort of shows us how there are some limitations on this kind of create your own reality thing. That is, you know, if you're a Pollyanna and you say, we don't want any evil in our bookstore, so we can't have your book because it has evil in the title. And that's a little bit like the people who, you know, if I told them, well, maybe you should listen to my radio show about, you know, Trump and Hillary, and you might learn some things and you might not want to vote for them. Then those people might say, oh no, I don't want to hear about this evil. You know, I create my own reality, and in my reality, Hillary is a nice grandmotherly figure, or in my reality, Trump is a national savior who's going to make America great again. And so I'm creating my own reality.
Right, and that's such, I mean, I could write a book about how that's such a delusion, and that's so unbelievably ignorant, and, you know, I don't want to, because I can go on forever about that, because that, I know people like that, and they super trigger me. But what you were just describing, one of the things that's going on there is people get really attached to their image of reality. And, you know, so they'll say, for example, they'll drink the Kool-Aid of mainstream media in whatever way, whatever the content is. And then so they'll, you know, have a particular point of view about, oh, Hillary's good or Trump is bad or the world is this way or whatever it is. And then if somebody like you or like me comes and actually puts that into question and says, well, actually, if you look at it that way, if you look at it, how about like this, you'll see that that's an illusion. That's not necessarily true. People have a disincentive to see that because it actually it's shocking. It creates a form of trauma. So people oftentimes are invested in holding on to their illusion as compared to seeing the truth, because it's kind of painful to realize, oh, my God, I've been hoodwinked.
And it's also painful, I think, to realize that we're powerless in ways that we didn't realize, because, you know, I think we're all brainwashed in this culture into imagining that we're actually not powerless because we can vote for leaders. And of all the leaders we vote for, the most important ones, the biggest leaders, are the presidents, right? So if we vote for president, we pick a candidate, and preferably a candidate that actually wins, then we are somehow powerful. It was my vote that put Obama in office or whatever. It wasn't my vote, that's for sure. I voted for Cynthia McKinney and then Merlin Miller in 2012. But you know what I'm saying is, a lot of people feel like their vote somehow is giving them this power. And then if you really take apart their faith in the system and in these candidates, the mainstream candidates that have a chance of winning, according to the media, then they feel like you're kind of disempowering them. You're sort of like, you know, castrating them or whatever. You're taking away this fantasy that gives them this, you know, antidote to their sense of powerlessness.
Yeah, but that's true. But their sense of their own power, it's an illusion. That's part of the brainwashing. In that, yeah, we and if we buy into the narrative that we're powerless, then we're also colluding in our own victimization. Because, so for just let me, I'll put it in terms of Watiko. So here Watiko According to the Native Americans, it's the greatest epidemic sickness known to humanity, and it can destroy our species. And yet, ultimately speaking, it doesn't even exist. It doesn't even have any substantial, independent, intrinsic existence separate from our own consciousness. So here's something that doesn't even exist that can literally destroy our species. How do we understand that? What I'm pointing out in my book is that what the meaning of that is that we have this incredible power inside of us as creative beings, but it's invisible to us because we've been, like you were saying, we've been brainwashed. We haven't tapped into it. So then we identify with all these false modes of being powerful, where we're actually not really in touch with our true power. Now, let me just give you an example on the current stage, the world theater, with the Dakota Pipeline, with Standing Rock. All of a sudden, all of these Native American tribes, are coming together, and a lot of them have been enemies historically. And it's, so I'm sure you're aware of it, and probably everybody is, but some people aren't because it's being blacked out by the mainstream media. But here are these Native Americans, and they're doing ceremony, and they're, trying to stop the, this multi-billion-dollar pipeline that's all about profits and all this stuff because it's desecrating their sacred land and might really pollute their drinking water, their source of life. But they're tapping into, there's incredible power when we join together as one and really speak our voice and just come together as community. That's an example of what's available to us.
That's right. And the power, real power, I think, is the power of creation, of the universe, of existence, of truth. I mean, that's the real power, and there's so much of it. It's a little bit like this, free energy thing. People say that Tesla's free energy has been covered up. The universe is seething with free energy, and all we would have to do is just tap a little bit of it. We'd have way more than we'd ever need. Well, that might be true. But it's also true at a kind of a psychological, metaphysical level that, sheer existence is this amazing kind of gift that we ought to be overwhelmingly grateful for. There's so much power in just the free existence around us that by simply letting go of this petty little concern for self and seeing it, or uniting with it, or surrendering to it, that is real. That's the only power that matters. And so much of what passes for power, what people are addicted to and cling to, is this sense of separation from that. And that's the exact opposite of power. I mean, if you fight your whole life trying to separate from this amazing gift of existence and all that power all around you, you'll accumulate a thimbleful of power, and it'll be taken away from you in a horrible way when you die. And then maybe even after you die, your consciousness might not be in such a great place. So, that's why, surrender, Dorothy, is really the last word here. And you're not going to get power by fighting it. You're only going to get power by letting go and being the very power that surrounds you, the power of existence.
Yeah, no, well, totally. You were mentioning like the free energy, and I'm very aware of that. I know I have friends who were part of that movement, and some of the inventors, and all that. And every single one tells me the same thing, that the greatest impediment to bringing in free energy into the world is the consciousness of people, that we just can't even imagine that that's actually possible, because we've been so brainwashed or entranced or entrained into this limited, separate, point of view, where, we've just so disconnected from who we are and from the incredible power that we have access to. And it's not power over others. And in Tibetan Buddhism, they'll talk about the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the teacher, the teaching, and the community. And more and more, I've been hearing that teachers are saying, well, the most important of that is the Sangha, is the community, that there's incredible power when we have the realization of that our nature, that we are interconnected with each other and with the world, with the universe, that we're interdependent on each other, that we literally don't exist as separate beings. And this is exactly what quantum physics has discovered, that there's no separate entities. There's no like building blocks that exist in an isolated fashion that compose reality. No, it's all this infinite interrelationships, and there's not a reference point anywhere. There's no separation. So here, like, the cutting edge of quantum physics is actually reflecting back the very thing that the spiritual traditions have been saying for millennia.
And what would it take for such a divided nation as the USA to realize this kind of sense of community, to let go of these bogus divisions and feel like one community again. It's trying to imagine how this could come out in history. What could actually happen?
Well, I think like one example is what's happening at Standing Rock, and because the powers that be that control the mainstream media, they're either putting out this disinformation about what's happening, or they're blacking out. They're not really covering what's happening because they're incredibly afraid. It would be their worst nightmare for more and more people to get turned on to the deeper, because at Standing Rock, there's this incredible, it's a mythic, this archetypal process that's becoming fully incarnate of, like, in a way, the powers of dark and light are like confronting each other. And the point is that the powers that be don't want people to know about it, because as more of us find out about it and actually support the Native Americans, then it's like here in the world theater, we're literally given an opportunity to access the power of coming together as a collective species, where we have the recognition of, yeah, we're all interdependent. If it's hurting one person, it's hurting me. If it's hurting the environment, it's hurting us. And so, your question, it just brings up, but that's actually happening right now. And so many of us are not aware of it. So I would just really encourage people to just put into a search engine about, the Dakota Pipeline, Standing Rock, any of those terms, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we talked about that on this week's False Flag Weekly News a fair bit. And, I hate to be pessimistic, but sometimes I think it might take something a bit more seemingly disastrous. Like, when I was in the Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco in, what was that, 1989 or something?
89, yeah.
Yeah, that brought the city together. I mean, people would have thought that there'd be a lot of looting and people would be at each other's throats and they'd be terrorized and all of that. But actually, the power was out for a few days and people pretty much pulled together. And likewise, I'm thinking, like, if Art Olivier is right and a giant EMP burst takes out our grid and takes out our computers and our internet and everything, he thinks this is coming on November 26th. So mark your calendars, folks. If that were to happen, or something like that were to happen, even though our connections with each other, the internet and Facebook and stuff, where we fight with each other about, oh, you like Hillary, I like Trump or whatever, that all's gone, right? And here we are, we're just stuck with, like, actual human beings, no electronic communications with them, and a whole lot of serious physical problems to solve. I wonder if we could pull together and solve those problems.
Yeah, well, that's a great contemplation, because, for me, like, as you were saying that, as we're getting close to the end of, our time together here, I'm thinking, wow, the antidote to, what the Native Americans call Watiko, which is really a collective psychosis, is what it is. The antidote is to connect with the true nature, whose expression is compassion. Because when you have compassion, you've seen through that separation. It's going back to that thing we were talking about, that to the extent, we've been brainwashed, we identify with being an ego or a separate self, and the expression of that is fear and all that. And that's really kind of the fundamental process that informs all of the insanity that's playing out. But the idea of, like, when you're in a dream and you actually have the recognition that you're dreaming, and you realize, oh, wow, these dream characters are not separate from me. We're all actually part of one greater being. There's not, there's not a separation here. It's all one quantum system. The expression of that realization is compassion. And that's the dissolver. That's the Watiko dissolver par excellence.
All right. I mean, brother, we're going to have to leave it there at the end of the hour. And I know you have a group to facilitate. So thank you, Paul Levy, for your incredible work. I think these are some of the most important books out there and have influenced my thinking as much as anything I've read in the last decade. So these two.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, Kevin. Really.
Yeah, it's just great stuff. And once again, the names are Watiko, the greatest epidemic sickness known to humanity, and then the madness of George W. Bush. Well, thank you, Paul Levy. Keep up the great work and look forward to another conversation down the road, God willing.
Fantastic. I want to thank you so much, Kevin. Okay. Bye-bye.
Right, bye.
Life has its music, life has its song. Life is but a dream. We can make.